Hey, Bat Cousins. Before we start the show, we wanted to let you know that the sound quality of our guest in this episode is somewhat crackly in the beginning, but it does get better.
Actually, we weren't going to mention this, but we found out the penguin was wiretapping our lines, and that was causing the interference. We contacted Batgirl and Robin, and luckily, they were able to put a stop to it a few minutes into our recording. So thanks, Babs and Dick.
Hi, this is Bob Rozakis. You're listening to the Batman Family Reunion on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Batman Family Reunion, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Sean M. Myers, one of your hosts, and with me as always is my co-host and Bat cousin, Paul Keene. How are you this month, Paul?
I'm feeling great, Sean. Bat Uncle Olin and I were just talking, and man, what a great voice he has. How about you?
I am great, Paul. I went to an O's game with the grandkids, and even though I still think I hate sports, I absolutely loved it. I ran into our Bat niece, Danielle, who works for the team as their Bat Boy. Well, I guess she's their Bat Girl. We want to welcome to the reunion a first-time podcaster and great supporter of the show, our favorite Bat DJ, Matthew Davis. Hey, Matthew, how are you? And what did you bring to the reunion?
Hey, I'm doing fine. Brought a couple different things. First, brought my mother-in-law's chicken and wine sauce, and
Ooh.
also fixed up some of my late mother's potato salad in hopes that maybe if I put it out there, I'll find the recipe for it.
So, Matthew, tell us your secret origin. We'd love to hear about how you got started with comics and Batman family and all that.
Well, my dad was in the army. I was born in Georgia, but grew up in Oklahoma and then lived in Germany for 3 years from like late 72 to late 75. I mean, I read comics, but at that time I was mostly the Goldkeys, Harveys, Marvel Westerns. But living over there, we had one TV channel, Armed Forces Network. Really didn't get into Batman until we moved back, discovered more than one channel. There are a total of three, and also found the Super Friends and reruns of the old Batman and Superman TV shows, and
Nice.
saw that little blurb based on characters and appearing in these comics. And then I started seeking out the comics. It just went from there.
And that was it. How about the Batman family? Did you read this book, either the Batman family or Detective?
Oh, yeah. Probably the first issues I picked up off the newsstand were probably issues three or four.
Ooh, okay,
Wow.
yeah.
And
Nice.
Batman Family, and was also reading Detective and Detective all through the Englehart Rogers run. I think a little bit before that, and all through that. And of course, into when the family moves over into the Detective.
All right. Paul, why don't you remind our listeners of what our show is all about?
Batman Family was a DC comic that ran 20 issues from 1975 to 78, and then was rescued by Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing on as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980. The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints, before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even Tales of Gotham City and Black Lightning. Both of your hosts collected and read these comics as they came out and are excited to share their love of this era at the Batman Family Reunion. So let's get into Detective Comics number 491, starring the Batman family, Sean.
All right, this issue was cover dated June 1980. The release date is March 27th, 1980. The page count is 64 pages with a cover price of $1. There are five stories, and the cover artist is Ross Andrew and Dick Giordano. Matthew, can you describe the cover and tell us what you think of it?
Yeah, I've never been really against box covers the way you are, Sean, but I don't, well, this is probably more of a columned cover, and it
Column
looks
cover,
kind
yeah.
of, well, let's go left to right. First, we got the assassination of Batgirl, and she's being shot to pieces. Very dramatic. Then we got Batman wrapped up and being wrapped in this yellow cloth, announcing the return of Maxie Zeus. Very fashionable. And then we got Robin swinging overhead Dick Grayson, who's looking very pensive, very drab. And then we got a blurb down here saying plus Black Lightning and more. I've seen better covers.
Yeah.
I went already buying this title. I don't know if it would have gotten my attention to buy it off the newsstand.
Ross Andrew's a great artist. We know that. And I think his Batgirl looks good. We know that's the dummy, not the real Batgirl, because it's being broken in half.
Right.
I thought that looks good. I would have rather seen that be maybe the full cover and the other ones be smaller. I don't think the Batman center image works. And then the Robin side, in my mind, is just kind of boring. You got Robin swinging over. We're not sure what he's doing. And then Dick Grayson is thinking, you know, what should I have for lunch? It kind of looks like, doesn't look like, I agree with you. If I wasn't familiar with this comic, I'm not sure this one would be enticing enough to be my first. How about you, Sean?
Yeah, so this is where I kind of have to delineate between boxed covers. So I don't like boxed covers because to me, a boxed cover is they basically took what would have been the cover and just shrunk it down into the corner. That to me is a boxed cover. I like that you called it a columned cover. Yeah. I like that. I don't mind like a column layout. I think that is fine, especially because there are different stories. But yeah, the tough thing is the top one third of the page is almost all entirely trade dress. I don't understand why they couldn't have made the Detective Comics logo just a little bit smaller, or actually put it up where it says featuring the entire Batman family. My problem is the Batgirl column is the most dramatic, the most exciting. You're not necessarily scared for her because you can tell it is cutting into pieces. It's not like,
but it's the most interesting one.
Yes. I think my issue is the Batgirl column is vertical and Batman is vertical. But then Robin is in two halves. So you kind of have Robin swinging at the top and then Robin or Dick Grayson thinking. So it kind of throws off symmetry or balance. I don't think it's horrible. I don't think it's atrocious. I don't think it's the worst one. The center thing of Batman, you don't really understand what is going on.
Yeah, what's going on.
And partly because you only see one pair of hands. If you could have seen, I guess, the other pair of hands, like
maybe
twisting him up, I guess that would have been better.
Yeah, maybe. It just suffers from too much the way a lot of these later detective covers have been, where they feel they've got to squeeze everything. Maybe there's that one person who's just buying it because they see that Maxi Zeus is in it or whatever.
By the way, if you're that one person buying it for Maxi Zeus, please let us know, because we want to talk to you.
Absolutely. All right, well, we will post the image of the cover as well as plenty of additional pages from each of the stories in our Family Portrait Gallery on the network's website. Sean, could you please remind our listeners where that is?
Absolutely. Fireandwaterpodcast.com. Now we're going to jump into our first story, which is The Riddle of the Golden Fleece, starring Batman. It's 17 pages, written by Denny O'Neill, penciled by Don Newton, inked by Dan Adkins, and it was later reprinted in Tales of the Batman Don Newton hardcover from 2012. Batman in The Riddle of the Golden Fleece. Wayne Foundation comes under attack by some thieves who are after a synthetic golden fiber created from wool by Professor Price. After knocking out the security guard, the thieves gas the professor and Bruce and try to get away, but the Batman makes use of the Wayne Foundation's prominent feature and fights them at ground level. After defeating them, Batman notices that one of the bad guys bears a resemblance to Hephaestus, Zeus's blacksmith.
Because of course he does.
Yeah. As Batman is carrying the unconscious Fred Britt, the lookalike, Fred becomes even more unconscious because he's shot. The shooter gets away, though. We then check in on Maxi Zeus, who is summer holidaying at Arkham, when he receives a visit from Fred Britt / Hephaestus. Maxi knocks out this obvious imposter and then escapes. When Fred takes off his mask, we see the pointed ears of Batman, who is in disguise. He also points out that he already has the mystery solved. And you can't see me, but I'm rolling my eyes at that. We then go to a girls' school where Maxi is visiting his daughter, Medea. Not that one. But instead of Maxi giving her the golden fleece, Batman gives her a doll. Zeus and Batman recap the case and Maxi goes back to Arkham. We then go to Price's lab where Batman visits Price and O'Hara, the knocked out security guard from the beginning of the story. Batman lets O'Hara know that he knows that it was he who substituted a phony bolt of the golden fleece for the real thing and that he knows he killed Brett. O'Hara then kills the Batman and makes his escape. Except, of course he didn't, because we still have six more episodes of Batman Family Reunion to do. And Batman confronts him again, but this time tells him that he replaced the bullets in his gun for blanks. Matthew, what did you think of this story?
Well, first I want to know, where's the Riddler? I mean, they got Riddle in the title. How do they do that and not have the Riddler in the story? I mean, you just got to wonder about Bruce Wayne. He will let anyone use his labs for experiments these days, or at least in those days. Yeah, I have some thoughts on this. I mean, wouldn't creating gold from wool cause a worldwide financial disaster?
Probably.
We're switching over to the wool standard.
page three, you can see Bruce reaching for his nose filters that he references down at the end, down at the bottom of the page.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, the art is really good. I enjoyed the story overall, Sean. It felt a little padded, but there's a lot of fun moments, so I'm okay with it. I thought there was good characterization of both Batman and Maxie. Just as an FYI, I was actually in high school in a production of Medea, and I played Jason, her husband. I get killed and everything. How about you, Sean? What did you think overall?
So I'll be honest, when I started writing this recap, man, I just did not understand what was going on. I actually Googled the Riddle of the Golden Fleece and Batman, and I didn't AI it. I didn't cheat. I did really write mine, but I definitely used the other one kind of like as a template, and that helped me get through. They got away with the Golden Fleece, but then why didn't they? So then I didn't understand that he substituted it. I kind of think it's okay. Plus also, Maxie has a daughter. Did we know this? Was this, I don't know.
We didn't know it, but Bruce apparently knew it.
Yeah.
You know what I really like? I think Lizanne would really love the purple suit that Bruce is sporting on pages 2 and 3, because he's really looking dapper. He's got a 3-piece suit with a blue tie and a white shirt and a purple outfit. So Lizanne, let us know what you think of that outfit for sure. I note in how you mentioned, Matthew, that we do see Bruce go for his nose filters in the middle of page 3. And so I thought that was a nice touch by Denny and Don.
Yeah. And of course, he swings down the tree, which is fantastic. I love that.
Yeah,
Make use of your architecture.
Absolutely.
I was going to say on page 4, normally they would do it where the photo would look right side up, but here it's upside down in a way.
That's a cool angle. I mean, if you turn the page upside down, it almost looks like you would expect it. I think it's a cool angle. I don't know what it's not foreshortening. Maybe it's top shortening. I don't know. Rob can tell us what the right terminology is, but definitely include that page. I want to know how Batman knows what Hephaestus looks like.
Yeah.
Can you explain that one?
I guess maybe with characters like that, I guess you have an eye. I mean, Superman's not real, but like when
we all know what he looks like.
When Christopher Reeve was cast as Superman, they're like, oh my god, yeah, he looks a guy like Superman. So maybe
he saw some photos in Wonder Woman's place in the JLA satellite or something.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm sorry we didn't get a cameo from the Joker walking around.
I'm surprised they didn't put someone in that we knew, that we recognized. So page 8, when Hephaestus comes, is he supposed to have something wrong with his neck? In both of his face shots, his head is craned to the side.
Even in the one to the left of that, it looks like he's walking with a limp or something. Yeah. It almost looks like he's supposed to be disabled or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely see that.
We always talk about him having the cowl on under the mask. And here, they're definitely trying to intimate that the cowl isn't covering his face. You see him pulling out his face. And then you see him pulling the cowl down.
Yeah.
But still, I don't know exactly where that cowl is in the map.
Maybe that's why it was creaked to the side with his head, because the cowl was stuffed in the wrong spot and it hurt.
I think the only thing that would be acceptable is if we see him pull out his ear or
stick it on, screw it on at the top.
I love when fake Hephaestus is coming to the guy from Arkham, says, Maxie Zeus escaped, walked right out of the gate, and it's your fault. He's so mad at that. We now talk about it all the time. That lets us know where Zeus will be. As for the rest of the case, the answers have been obvious from the beginning. Oh, they have not. This is not a fair play story. Thank you. There's not a...
Like, not even close.
I hate that.
I do like the dialogue that the goons have in front of the home for girls. Like, I don't know if I think about this guy, Maxie Zeus. He's like, he's nuts, but he's smart. And we always get paid. And I'm like... I don't know, I just like that kind of stuff.
I can't believe they didn't throw in, he's on par with the Joker and Ra's al Ghul in his villainy.
So then we have a cute scene where the little girl comes up and gives Maxie Zeus a big hug. So I do like, tell me what you think about this, guys. Mm-hmm. Pages 12 to 13. I like the compassionate Batman. I would have liked to have been in the store when the Batmobile pulls up and he gets out and asks to buy a doll.
Oh, you know he sent Alfred in to get it.
Maybe so.
I kind of just don't even get, why is this here? I guess in mythology, Medea wanted the Golden Fleece. I guess that's how it ties this in. But it's, I don't know. I guess theoretically, I understand the mythological Medea and the Golden Fleece. But does this little girl want it? Or Maxie is getting her, gets a present that the parents giving the kid that the kid doesn't care about. I guess that's why it strikes a nerve. But I think it's just...
He should have brought her a bunch of digests, storm.
Here's a bolt of cloth, honey.
Golden cloth. What's she going to do? Make all new uniforms for everyone at the school?
Yeah, really, out of gold.
The only way I would have liked this if Medea and her classmates were cleaning the room until it shined like the top of the Chrysler building. That was for you, Martin.
Well, it was a hard knock life there. So anyway, just kind of fun, interesting. I think Denny's big farewell was last issue.
All that stuff.
So Denny's going to go over and edit Daredevil and stuff like that. So he's got good things coming, but he's gone out a little bit of a whimper here, in my opinion.
So one thing I wanted to say, I do really appreciate that Professor Price doesn't have an arm, but it's never addressed in the story, which I love. I thought that was fantastic.
That was really interesting. I think that was just a choice from Don Newton.
I love that.
Anything else to say about this one? All right, let's move on to the Bat timeline. So as usual, in this segment, we're going to take a look at the other titles that were published this month. Thanks again to Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics. And these titles were released in March of 1980. Let's start with those Bat books. The first one up is Batman number 324, and this is one of my favorite Jim Aparo covers. You've got a battle-damaged Batman emerging from a giant sewer pipe, holding on to the unconscious Catwoman. Great storyline where Catman is trying to frame the reformed Catwoman. Great stuff inside Len Wein, Irv Novik, and everybody's seen this cover. It's a terrific, terrific cover by Jim Aparo, and a great storyline to go along with it.
I actually had this book, well, I can't say off the shelves, because I got it at Rutter's, and Rutter's is kind of like a 7-Eleven, but Rutter's had spinner racks, so I got it out of the spinner rack. But reading that issue, I had never heard of Catman. I didn't know that he was really a real thing. Rolled my eyes. They've done so much more with Catman in the Secret Six and that kind of stuff. Yeah, so it's much better.
I'm not sure he had a lot of appearances between his Silver Age and this, which is why it was kind of a surprise and Len Wein brought him back. So I think that's what the deal was. I don't recall exactly, but terrific run of Batman at this time.
I agree. Yeah, that run was fantastic.
Yeah.
Next up, Brave and the Bold, number 163, and it's Batman and Black Lightning, and the story is called Oil, Oil Nowhere, and it's a great cover. Batman and Black Lightning, and they're in front of oil tanks, and Black Lightning is saying, if just one bullet hits the oil tank, the city goes up in flames. That's an exciting cover, so that's really good.
And Justice League number 179, we have Firestorm joining the Justice League. A great Jim Starlin cover, of course, inside Jerry Conway and Dick Dillon. So that's big doings up at the satellite. This is the one where Superman's saying, hey, this guy's joining the league no matter what you guys say about it, because Superman sponsored him, as we know. I remember that cover too. A lot of very memorable covers this month.
Next up is Super Friends number 33, and it is The Secret of the Stolen Solitaire. And it's a great cover. It has Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, and they are going after animals. Some birds have kryptonite in their talons, so they're going after Superman. Batman's trying to stop. Is that a bison or an ox or a yak? I don't know what that is. But Hawkman is also on the cover, and it says, back off, Superman. Those falcons are carrying deadly kryptonite. And the villain of the issue is the Menagerie Man. Now, the first time I read Super Friends and came across the Menagerie Man, I didn't know what a menagerie was. I didn't know that word. So in my mind, I was reading it Menagerie, the Menagerie Man.
And then finally, we have World's Finest Comics number 263. You know, weirdly, I have recently reread this. I was reading a bunch of Bronze Age Aquaman, believe it or not. And this is only one of three issues that Aquaman got stuffed into. But this is better known from the story of the final Secret of the Super Sons, where we find out that Superman Jr. and Batman Jr. were a computer-generated dream, shall I say, or that Batman and Superman would take part in from time to time. That's a Denny O'Neill story. I always thought, whoa, that's weird. But Denny just, I guess, felt like he had to do something from all those Bob Haney stories. You just didn't care when the Super Sun showed up. It's at least a very interesting story and wrap up to those stories. Yeah. So, Matthew, what was on your pull list? Now, how old were you in March of 1980?
Oh, Lord, I was 13. I was always primarily a DC guy. Once I started getting into the superheroes, and I started getting into Marvel 81, 82, a couple years after this, meeting some guys in high school that were reading Marvels. I think one thing I would have had on my pull list would have been X-Men, because that's right in the heart of the Dark Phoenix saga.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I got all the Superman, Batman, Justice League, Flash, Green Lantern, getting all those off the newsstand at the time. Adventure Comics, that Starman, one of you two had talked about it on a previous episode, and yeah, that was a really good storyline.
Sean read it on his last vacation.
Yeah, exactly. So the Starman story is neat because they talk about the politics of their society and how if you're a ruler and you get voted out, you die. There is some good
world building
underlying principle. Yeah. So it's definitely worth, I had all those issues for Plastic Man because I didn't care about Starman. So if you're like me and didn't bother reading Starman, it is worth reading it. Definitely.
What else did you have, Sean?
Okay. I had, of course, Action Comics number 508. And that is a fantastic storyline. Jonathan Kent comes back to life. It is great. The cover is battle damaged Superman coming into the window. Jonathan Kent is saying something like Hassan Pfeffer or Holy Moly or something like that. Who could have done that to you, my son? And Lois is there and she's like, your son? That means Superman is Clark Kent. It is neat because Jonathan Kent does come back, but obviously he doesn't come back. It's done really, really well. And maybe we'll get to it in a couple months. I forget. But I read this two-part story in the Year's Best Comics Digest, the second collection that they did. So
excellent.
My next story is The Flash number 286. And I love this cover. Just in time for Pride Month, last month. But it's who is the Rainbow Raider? And can the Crimson Comet discover his grim secret before he becomes its next victim? So you have this white silhouette and then all these rainbow colors coming out. Flash doesn't have any color. It's the colors from the rainbow. I had this issue, I had a subscription to The Flash in sixth grade, and we were getting into colors and prisms and that kind of stuff. And I showed it to my science teacher.
All right. Awesome.
And it's great because the Rainbow Raider's real name is Roy G. Bivolo.
Yes.
So this is an example of why I really don't like the Showcase collections where they're all reprinted in black and white, because this story leans so heavily on color. Rainbow Raider draws the color out. It just doesn't work in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I had to pick Legion of Superheroes. No surprise to anyone, because front and center is Tyrock, a fantastic pose. It's comic convention season. I pray to God I see someone cosplaying as Tyrock. I would love that. Maybe if he goes up against Grimbor, that might be okay. My next one is, of course, New Adventures of Superboy number 6. Superboy's saying goodbye to Ma and Pa Kent, but obviously he doesn't. And then, of course, I am trying to make Spider-Woman happen in my collected form. This is issue number 27, where she battles the Enforcer. And it's a great cover because there's some quote-unquote dead guy, glasses askew, battle damage. And then Spider-Woman's in the background and the Enforcer is saying, either he dies or you do. Choose.
Early Bill Sienkiewicz cover, which surprised me.
Oh, wow. That really surprises me. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Joe Rubenstein is the inker, so I think he got rid of a lot of the sharp edges. But yeah, that's a good one.
Is that like a case of where Giffen used to do beautiful art and then he went to ugly?
Yeah, they changed their styles.
Yeah, that cover doesn't
look, you know, somebody good. Like him was supposed to conform and then he got popular enough he could do what he wanted.
My next one is Time Warp number 5. Beautiful logo. We talked about that. I'd like to get this one. There's an alien that almost kind of looks like a Starfire just because of the coloring of her outfit. But there's, I don't know, like 8 stories in that dollar comic. And then my last one is Walt Disney, The Black Hole number 2.
Keeps on giving 3 months in a row, man.
I had this issue of The Black Hole and I
drew, yeah, we're sure you did.
I drew this issue of The Black Hole.
Sure.
I wrote this issue of The Black Hole. What's on your pull list, Paul?
So a couple things to mention real quick. So Spider-Man number 205, this is the first issue written by David Michelinie. He takes over the writing duties from Marv Wolfman, who now has moved over to DC. So we're sort of trading Danny O'Neill from Marv Wolfman at the time. He continues a lot of the storylines, though, including the Black Cat subplot. It's a cool cover where she's sort of smashing a chandelier down at Spidey. We talked last month about the first cameo appearance of Taskmaster. You got a great George Perez cover on Avengers 196 showcasing the Taskmaster. Terrific. And I don't remember if we've talked about Battlestar Galactica on the show, Sean. I don't remember if we have, because it probably was in opposite months when we were bi-monthly. I did get most of them. I know I liked the show at the time, but I recall absolutely nothing about the comics. I guess we all remember the rebooted show better, and because that was a much better show. You gotta like Doctor Strange, number 41, because it guest stars whoever knows fear burns at the touch of the man thing. And so speaking of Bill Sienkiewicz, Fantastic Four 219, part of the reason I realized that is that's his first color work. So up at this point, he's only done maybe half a dozen black and white magazines. Moon Knight at that time was in the Hulk magazine. His pencils were really smoothed out by Joe Sinnott. Great cover of the Fantastic Four battling a giant robot. My off the beaten path this month would have been Marvel Premiere number 54, The Coming of Caleb Hammer. I don't know anything about this, but the cover is by Frank Miller and Tony DiZuniga, which I didn't really know much about that combination. So inside Gene Day and Tony DiZuniga inks. Just a really cool looking Western cover. I'm not much for Western comics, but I don't know. You said you like Western comics. Do you ever buy this one, Matthew?
I don't remember Caleb Hammer. I mean, I remember Rawhide Kid, Kid Cole, Two Gun Kid. I seem to remember Marvel did kind of a more realistic revival of the Westerns in something called Blades of Glory.
Yeah, I didn't read those. I vaguely recall that.
Yeah, it was like late 90s. And I think Caleb Hammer was in there, but I don't remember Caleb Hammer. By this point, I was beyond getting the Westerns.
Something for you to look for this convention season, The Coming of Caleb Hammer. So. And then my last one, finally, weirdly, the final issue of Supervillain Team-Up number 17 shows up over a year after the last issue. This one has the Red Skull with Arnim Zola and the Hatemonger. It's always a bad sign when the Red Skull gets a hold of the Cosmic Cube. We have one last part of this. Sean, absolutely. Would you like to give us the count?
The Richie Rich cover count is 10.
10.
10 Richie Rich issues in the month of our Lord, March 1980.
Only 10. I guess it's not summertime yet.
A scant 10.
So let's move on to our second story. The Tales of Gotham City, a 7-pager written by Mike W. Barr. With pencils and ink by Dan Spiegel, who I know you're not a great fan of, Sean, but I think does a pretty decent job on this.
Yeah.
The Fragrance of Death, or I like to call it, The Secret Origin of Jason Bard. We open with Jason Bard placing flowers on a grave. The groundskeeper asks him why he does this every week. And Jason tells him that he owes this person a great debt because he was the man who killed Jason's father. The groundskeeper naturally wants more info. And so Jason indulges him and us. We learn that Jason grew up with an abusive father who was a small-time crook. He and his mother left when he was a young boy, and they moved around a lot and tried to stay ahead of him. But one day while Jason was at school, his father did catch up with them and demanded money from his mother. When she refused, Jason's father killed her. As we know, Jason later went to Vietnam and got his bum knee there. Coming home, he used the GI Bill to get his PI license, and one of the reasons he chose that career was so that he could hunt down his father. But Jason doesn't even have a memory of what his father looks like. There are only two clues he has to go on. He knew his father was very allergic to roses, and that he had a scar on his right hand from when he attacked his mother. One night, one of Jason's regular informants, Scratch, calls him and says, hey, you still got an open reward of $1,000 for info on a small-time crook allergic to roses? He tells Jason that two guys just blew into Gotham, and one of them paid the flower lady $10 to move her cart somewhere else because of his allergy to roses. Scratch arranges a meeting with the two hoods and a human-targeted disguise, Jason, with roses on the table, Natch. But they didn't take the bait, and they leave the meeting. After they leave, Jason removes his disguise, but finds an allergy pill in the ground, and now he knows he's on the right track. But just then, dear old dad bursts back into the room, threatening Jason. Seems he had figured out who Jason was, too. I guess he must have gotten his detective's gene from somewhere. Fisticuffs ensue, and Scratch jumps in to help Jason. In the confusion, Scratch and Jason's dad are both shot and killed. Scratch had saved Jason, and Jason is making sure he's remembered, spending that $1,000 he never got as a reward on his weekly flowers. Oh, and Jason's dad's last word? Rose. Not for the flowers, but that also happened to be the name of Jason's mom. The end. So guys, what'd you think? Matthew, let's start with you.
I really, really like this story. Going back and rereading it, I mean, I kind of remembered it from first reading it, then coming back to reread it now. I think it holds up. It is a really nice story. I mean, it's beginning, middle, end, great twist at the end. I thought it was a really nice story, probably the best story in the book.
That's a strong possibility. Sean, how about you? What do you think?
Yeah, I echo what Matthew is saying. Although, it shouldn't be a Tales of Gotham City. It should just be a Jason Bard story.
People don't understand Tales of Gotham City.
I don't understand that at all. Because I think Jason Bard would be more of a draw than Tales of Gotham City. Like, if it's Tales of Gotham City, I want it to be normal people or that kind of thing.
Yeah, the excitement of pushing his car out of the snow, for example.
But yeah, I liked it a lot. The interesting thing is they say about how Jason's mother's name was Rose, but her middle name was Bud.
Oh, Sean. I liked it too. I thought it was a terrific story. I thought the Spiegel art was appropriate and conveyed the story pretty well. I was curious to hear what you had to say about it, Sean, because I know you're not a fan, but I thought the story and the art went well together, and I did not remember anything about the story, Matthew, when I read it, and so I thoroughly enjoyed it. Not bad for a seven pager.
Yeah, I mean, it shows what can really be done in seven pages when a writer really puts their mind to it. I mean, Mike W. Barr is one of my favorites from the 80s. I love Batman and the Outsiders. And just shows what a really good writer he is.
Yeah, he's got some great stuff and got some wacky stuff. You know, we've had him a couple times on the show so far, and he's still just starting out. He likes to get his mysteries in there. Mm-hmm. He likes that little twist. He obviously was a fan of that twist at the end and a little bit of O. Henry. I'm not sure there's a lot of beats to walk through. It's a straightforward.
I think your recap did it.
I like the character of Scratch. I mean, Jason's a good guy. He's trying to remember Scratch as his sacrifice. I'm not sure why we had to have the fact that Jason's dad had a scar on his hand, because that didn't really come into the resolution. It was all about the roses, which is as it should be. The one action beat I liked was in the top of page 6, where his dad has a gun trained on him and he takes the pot of roses and flips it up right at him with his cane. I thought that was kind of a nice touch.
Although I wish he would have gone into a sneezing fit or something. In terms of the Spiegel art, I'm surprised because, yeah, I'm not a huge Dan Spiegel fan. Now, I do think close-ups he does really well.
Yeah.
When it's flashing back to the mom and Jason, I don't think those are delineated very well. So on page 2, panel 1, I do love that Jason is talking to the Gorton's fisherman about what's happening with the flowers.
He does more look like a sea captain than he does like...
Or like maybe this could be a Gabriel's one. Or maybe Old Spice Man, like Old Spice Sailor.
Yeah, again, not a whole lot to say about it other than that. It's an entertaining story. I encourage you, anybody who's listening, to read it on DC Universe. You want to move on?
Now we're going to do bat branding, and that's where we take a look at the non-story pages in the issue. And I'm going to kick it off with a Twinkies ad with the Flash in a flash in the dam. And this is another one where this really could just be a page from a story, because the Twinkies have absolutely nothing to do with his plot whatsoever. So the Destroyer is going to destroy the dam. He starts to put a hole in it. Flash puts a bunch of rocks in the dam, stops it. He takes the Destroyer and then he puts him in front of a table. A table. I don't know where this table came from. He gave a table full of Twinkies. The Flash runs away and the Destroyer says, "You win, Flash. I'll give myself up." There's a lot. It's just so dumb.
On the opposite page, you'd get a terrific full-page ad for the Untold Legend of the Batman, Len Wein, John Byrne, Jim Aparo. You know, they still had to explain at the time what miniseries. Collect the series beginning with issue 1. Number 2 is May 22nd. Number 3 is on June 26th. You know, it's good. You got to explain what a miniseries is, which I find charming. Just terrific. I got the cover there. You got the shot of Batman holding up the Thomas Wayne Batman suit. Just a terrific image. We all love that storyline. Someday, maybe we will do something about that.
And I don't necessarily want to make work for other people, but I believe Rob Kelly is possibly thinking about doing a podcast just about comic book covers. The Untold Legend of the Batman cover number 1 is fantastic. There's this huge Batman book and Joker, Penguin, and Riddler are going to read it. They're going to like open it up. It's probably twice the size that they are. It's like a treasury with a treasury with a treasury with a treasury with a treasury. So the exact opposite of a treasury is a digest, and that is the beautiful ad in the middle of the book. So it's 2 kids, and 1 kid is, "How can magazines this small?" And then I come in and I say, "Be so big in reading pleasure."
I thought that was you, Sean.
That is me right there. Look,
it was a bowl haircut.
I had both of these issues off the newsstand. DC Special is Justice Society. I was used to the Justice Society from the team-ups each summer, but I had never read an entire Justice Society story. Mm-hmm. So that's in there. There's the All-Star where Power Girl and Star Spangled Kid joined. And then, of course, we could do a Fire and Water Presents, because they also reprinted the Dr. Fate solo story in this issue. So that could be my. And then the other book is The Best of DC Digest, number 6, but they're all stories having to do with the Daily Planet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is kind of where it clicked in my head. The digests are oftentimes themed around a particular story point. So all of this had stories having to do with the Daily Planet. I'm sure in this issue, the Daily Planet globe probably has exploded 14 times. There's maybe only 6 stories. In fact, that should be... So Isamu, I am not making you do this. Do not do this. If you do this, I'm going to be mad. So let someone else do it. But there should be a list of every time the globe on top of the Daily Planet building got blown
up. I think that list would be too low.
Do not do that. I am forbidding you to do it, Isamu. Do not. If you do it, I'm going to block you from ever listening to us again.
Well, just wait to listener feedback, listeners, for something that Isamu did do.
Do not. Isamu, do not do it. Don't.
John, you realize you just guaranteed that he's going to do it.
No. So we're recording this video, but you never see it. I am crossing my hands and fists in front of my chest, and I'm wagging my finger. Do not do it, Isamu. No. If you do, I'm going to come after you like Jonah Hex going after his bounty, which leads us to the other page. It's 2 issues, Jonah Hex and Weird Western Tale with Scalp Hunter. I didn't have these. At the time, I didn't care about these. I got Jonah Hex because of the digests and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think Jonah Hex is cool. Absolutely great figure, like the way he looks.
And then right after the Robin story, they must have been a page short because we get a Batman pinup by Dick Dillon. And it says Smith. I assume that's Bob Smith, former Bat Family History subject. I kind of like this. There's one thing I'm not digging, but I like the purple background. It's basically what it is you got Batman swinging away from what appears to be Big Ben with a purple sky and a moon in the background and the cityscape at an askew angle. So it's a pretty cool Batman image. I always like Dick Dillon's Batman and Justice League. It's not as dynamic as a Perro or Neil Adams, of course, but for me, growing up, is very on model from the Justice League.
And so we're talking about this being a special bonus pinup. If you're remembering how the back page was the villains mm-hmm. in the Batcave prison and that fantastic shot of the table with a picture of Batman with a red X and all the villains are on there. Bat Cousins, if you don't have this and you want to see this pinup, I urge you to run to eBay and buy anything else other than this because you're going to be disappointed. I think this special pinup, I don't want to say it's atrocious. I don't know if dumb is the right word. It kind of looks like Batman was on the clock and is like jumping away from the clock using his rope. I just think it's...
I think the motion lines are on the wrong side. Looks like he's swinging from right to left.
Yeah.
You think he ought to be swinging from left to right. So I don't quite get that part of it either.
So remember the Tempo paperbacks, mm-hmm. how it's Batman and Two-Face on the clock and Batman and Robin is swinging. That's fantastic. They could have just reprinted that mm-hmm. and that would have been 10,000 times better than this pinup.
How about you, Matthew? What'd you think of this? I liked it more than Sean. Break the tie.
I was always a fan of the Justice League. And I like Dick Dillon's artwork. I mean, it's an okay pinup. I've seen other artwork that make for better pinups.
Yeah, I agree. I think this was Paul Levitz realized the Jason Bard story ran a page short and he running to Dick Dillon, who happened to be in the office. Can you give me a Batman pinup? And Dick said, sure. And an hour later, this is what you have. I liked it, again, better than you guys. The only thing I don't like is his left leg. I don't think that looks natural. I don't know whether that's the penciler or the inker's issue.
His right foot does look a little odd.
You know, we'll include it. Listeners in the gallery, you can decide for yourself. Facing that page is a neat ad, Thompson Team Up Thrills. We get an ad for both DC Comics Presents, where you've got Superman and Captain Comet, and the aforementioned Brave and the Bold with Batman and Black Lightning. We always like those sort of half-page ads. I guess they couldn't sell another half-page ad, so they put a house ad in here.
And our next ad is Superman's Bargain Counter. And it's one of the... We need to think of a term for that. It's the subscription ads with the corner box things. So Superman is saying, on the right are 12 consecutive monthly issues, which would cost you $4 when bought by subscription. On the left, the same 12 issues would cost you $4.80 when purchased separately. Which offer will you choose? The right one, of course. So you could subscribe to Action Comics, Superman, and DC. They also had a special subscription offer for DC Dollar Comics, Superman Family, and World's Finest. 6 $1 issues for only $5.
That's a good deal.
Issue free.
And then last but not least, Sean, take us through the Batcave.
We are going to go to the Batcave. And let me tell you, when I do these Batcaves, I take the issue and I make a photocopy of it and then I highlight it. Well, I had so much stuff highlight on this. Like I had to go back because our episodes are long. Oh my God, this would have been 14 hours. So I went back and I really, really pared down. with this, and it's probably still too much. But as always, we are inviting Henry R. Kuryawa, Scott Gibson, Bill Schwer, and Mark Ryan. If you're listening to us by any chance, please call in. Or please call in. Yeah, go ahead and call me or write in, and we'd love to have you on the show or even a comment, whatever. I'm going to start off with Henry. So Henry could be on this podcast right now because his opening statement is, Detective 487 amounted to just about an average issue for what is currently one of DC's top books. The mixture of triumph and tragedy within these pages usually leaves me with mixed feelings about each issue and the feeling that some things could be as good as others. That is exactly what we said every episode of the show. But later on, he says, so I'm skipping a little bit ahead because this is definitely a Gabriel's Horn moment, but we don't really do Gabriel's Horn for the letters comment. But he says, I'd bet you could put Starsky and Hutch against the Batman and they'd look like kids by comparison. And then the final comment from him, he talks about story number 4, The Odd Man. Huh? What? What is this? Is Steve Ditko gone crazier than Jack Kirby ever was? I don't want to direct my flabbergastedness at his main character so much as the general storytelling. A scripter, he's not. And why wasn't there any explanation for those villains? Sheesh. Although, all of those comments were why I loved that story.
Yeah, I thought you were going to read that part.
So my last one is Mark Ryan. So Mark Ryan, I love Mark Ryan and I hate Mark Ryan. Mark Ryan, please come on the show. The comment that I don't like at all, he says, Ma Murder came off quite well. No costumed showgirl like Poison Ivy, but a real hardcore organized crime figure. Well, first of all, let me tell you, Mark, showgirls don't besmirch the image of showgirls. And Poison Ivy, if she is a showgirl, is fantastic. Ma Murder is no Poison Ivy. However, he wins me back around when he says, finally, since Adventure kicked out Dead Man, could Tech pick up my favorite supernatural character and give him a home. He is a detective of sorts. He, after all, was charged with tracking down his own murder, which was a classic in every sense of the word for those of us who have got the originals. Mark, I love you.
We do get a long editorial from Paul Levitz, who then informs us about Danny O'Neill leaving for Marvel and replacing him on our regular Batman feature will be Jerry Conway or Marv Wolfman. But we do get Carrie Burkett for an issue or two. And that some of this stuff that's in here doesn't really happen, so I'm not going to go into it a whole lot. I think that's it. You guys ready to move on to the third story?
Yes.
All right. The third story is starring Robin, and it's called The Target of the Death Dealer. It's 8 pages written by Jack C. Harris, art by Alex Sabiuk and Vince Coletta, and reprinted in Robin the Bronze Age Omnibus. Robin is up a tree, literally, as he is tailing the mysterious Man in Black, who has been following Dick Grayson around the last couple issues, in full costume, in daylight on the Hudson University campus. He is interrupted as a driverless truck is about to plow into some students, so he has to wrangle the truck to avoid them. The group included his new main squeeze, Jennifer, as well as someone new, freshman Doris Dexter. Robin changes back to Dick and joins the group as they head to the school paper office. You know, the club that Dick participates in when the writer needs him to interact with some students. Anyway, when they get to the office, the printing press has been left on and is running hot. Kawam! It explodes, but Dick notices some equipment he thinks was sabotaged. Next, Doris and Jennifer are about to get into a car to deliver the papers when it too bursts into flame. Robin saves them too, of course. As the kids are describing their very, very bad day to the police, Doris's very, very tall brother, basketball star Ben, shows up. He wants nothing to do with the other kids and never wanted Doris to even come to Hudson University. Ben's behavior seems strange to Dick, so he tails him and overhears a phone call. Ben is telling the other party to leave his sister alone and he will throw the game. Robin confronts him, saying he will help, but Ben is noncommittal. During the game that night, Robin is watching from behind the scoreboard where no one is looking, right? He is scanning the crowd to see if someone there could be the blackmailer. He sees the driver of the errant truck from that morning, and then he recalls that the driver had made the comment that he was delivering new supplies to the gym. But Hudson is in budget cuts, so Robin determines he was lying and he must be the bad guy. Robin, of course, jumps onto the court where he passes the basketball to Ben, who flaps him out cold. The end. Guys, what'd you think of The Target of the Death Dealer?
Is it me or are the Robin stories at this time kind of uninspired?
Yeah.
The Man in Black does not have the same sense of danger as the Raven. I guess, I don't know, maybe it's hindsight, but you start thinking they've got plans for Robin. They don't want to get him involved in anything too big, big long storyline, because towards the end of the year, this year, we get the new Teen Titans.
I think it's just that Jack C. Harris isn't that good, Matthew.
Yeah. It could be that.
I don't know that they realized what they were going to have in the new Teen Titans. It took them a few months to say, hey, wait, we got something special here. Jack C. Harris, I'm sure he's written some good stories, but we way more enjoyed the Bob Rozakis stories that we had here. So that just is my two cents. Sean, how about you? What'd you think?
Jack C. Harris, the C stands for comment.
Yes.
Because someone always says something which makes the character think of something. I like the Man in Black subplot. I think that's interesting. I actually forget or don't know how it pays off.
Right. Neither do I.
I like that they're kind of building the supporting characters with the kids in the newspaper office when Robin shows up. I do kind of like that. It takes place in different parts of the campus.
Yeah.
And I do like that Robin ties in the basketball player, but all of those likes. There's nothing bad or wrong with it, but it's not exciting. It's not thrilling.
Once again, Dick has his van in the middle of the woods. Brett Young will like that.
Nothing weird or creepy about that.
Nothing weird or creepy about that. Even weirder, on the same page, so I'm looking at page 6, is the phone booth in the middle of the woods.
That's, I know. Although, I do kind of think, back then, I almost kind of can see there being a phone booth kind of in the middle of nowhere. I'm willing to give that more of a pass.
But then Robin drives by on the motorcycle, Screech stops, and jumps on top of the phone booth without the kid realizing that he's there. So, just a little silly. Now, I don't know if that's the art or what. I mean, Alex Saviak, okay, but it's kind of a little dull.
I've said really good things about him in the past, but I will say on page 1, on the quote-unquote splash page where Robin is swinging in, Robin is a man in that panel.
Yeah.
Look at those thighs. He's a man. But then when you look at page 4 and he picks up that metal thing from the printing press, he looks like he's 8 years old.
Yeah. And he does, yes.
Now, I will say, the great thing about this story is on page 4, the middle panel where she's holding up the newspaper, the Hudson Herald. The Hudson Herald headline is Professor Caught in Cheating Scandal, which is the story from last issue. And I love that. That is fantastic.
Yeah, that's a nice touch.
I was just going to say this about that phone booth. Page 6, bottom left, there's what looks like a dirt trail. So maybe it's a hiking trail or walking trail across campus.
It does look like
it. Might be a need for a phone booth there. I'm just surprised that Vinny Coletta left that detail in.
So I don't have a whole lot more to say about this one. I do like the little action at the end where Robin tosses the ball to the basketball player who flaps the guy in the back. Yeah. That page is laid out pretty well and Robin's cape is swirling around. Again, Alex Saviak, he's a professional. He knows what he's doing. He's just never one of my favorites. That's all.
We are going to move on to the fourth story, and that is titled Short Circuit, starring Black Lightning. 10 pages written by Martin Pascoe, penciled by Pat Broderick, inked by Frank McLaughlin. And it was later reprinted in Black Lightning Volume 2 trade paperback from 2018. Black Lightning in Short Circuit. Our story starts off where it left off last issue. Black Lightning, unconscious, while Lincoln Trask, one of Jefferson Pierce's students, is trying to break down a door to free them. BL wakes up, and although he doesn't have his electrical powers, he does have enough strength to free them. Lincoln, though, passes out from the smoke and exertion. After mouth-to-mouth revives Lincoln, BL races across rooftops to catch up to the van that is speeding away from where they were held captive. This gives Black Lightning time to recap last issue's story pretty thoroughly and gives him the opportunity to jump onto the van and then listen to Jacques tell his story of how a protection racket crippled his mother and how Jacques hatched the plan to steal BL's powers from the Voodoo deity because he is the Chawal of the Loa, who controls the elements.
Well done.
Black Lightning, though powerless, manages to stop the van, but also gets grazed by a bullet. Unfortunately, he then gets thwacked in the head and is about to be thrown off a bridge when he manages to hold onto the guardrail and flip himself over, smacking a guy's face with his boot in the process. Jacques and his mama are trying to get away when BL uses a hubcap as a discus. Because you may not know it, since it's only mentioned 432 times in every Black Lightning story, but Jefferson used to be an Olympic athlete to stop them. As Jefferson is talking to Lincoln the next day, he comes to realize that since he never really knew where his powers came from, He shouldn't rely on them, and just to use his own self. What did you think of the story, Matthew?
It is a pretty good story. I mean, I like Black Lightning. I like Pat Broderick's art. Yeah. It just seems like Black Lightning got a raw deal losing his powers. Despite the whole Aaron monologue about not using him as a crutch, I don't know. It just seems like he got a raw deal losing the powers like that.
Yeah, I mean, in a couple of years, he'll get them back, right?
By
the time they get to Batman the Outsiders. I agree with you. You know, he loses his powers. The status quo changed. This whole story's got a little too many words. But overall, I thought it was enjoyable, too. Now I'm curious to where it goes. We got a sort of two-parter opening up our experience with Black Lightning in the Batman Family magazine. So let's see where it goes.
One other thing I was going to mention. Yeah, he always says he's an Olympic athlete in the decathlon. He's a medalist. If I remember from the decathlon events were actually supposed to be training for combat.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Shot put and discus, javelin, throwing objects, pole vault to vault over.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Obstacles.
Maybe Captain Entropy knows something about the origins of the decathlon and its relation to the armed services. I did not know that. That's cool.
Well, I'm talking about in ancient Greece.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, he's not that old. He's not that old.
Hephaestus excelled at that.
Yeah, Hephaestus.
The Olympics are also this year, so we'll probably hear something about that at some point.
Sean, you didn't tell us your initial thoughts.
It's very much the same. I liked the story. Love the art. Love Pat Broderick, who I would know later from Fury of Firestorm.
Yep.
Why are you going to depower your superhero? I mean, I guess to make him more like, whatever, a Green Arrow or a Batman type. Right. But
yeah, he's the only one in this book that had any powers, you know. So again, I question some of Paul Levitz was a great manager of DC Comics. I'm not so sure some of his editorial decisions, like erasing Batgirl's memory in this one, were among the best. I don't know where that came from, but I agree. And they undo it. It doesn't take long. By the time he's in The Outsiders, he's got his powers back, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So that's only a couple years away.
And if I do say so myself, I think my recap was wonderful. So I don't know if we have to go beat by beat by beat by beat. But is there anything...
I have just two things I like to know.
I have one thing I want to go last because it's spectacular.
Okay. Page 4. I love his outfit. And again, Lizanne, you can let us know that the outfit, he's got this green fedora with a red flower and a puff on it. Just a great, great outfit. And then I do like that on pages 7 and 8, Black Lightning is using his brain and his athletic abilities. And that's what he's going to be doing for a while, right? He won't have his powers for a couple of years. And it's so nice to see, you know, we always see heroes getting knocked out. It's nice to see one faking it, using his brain to fake it. And that leads, of course, to a nice sort of upbeat ending. Again, it encourages me to want to read more.
So absolutely the best part of the story was the guest star, one of my favorite heroes ever. Absolutely loved it. You know what I'm talking about?
I do not.
On page 3, at the bottom, above the bottom two panels, you'll see Dead Man narrating the story.
Like Dead Man's face. That's funny. Listeners, we'll put that in there.
I loved that Boston Brand was inside Jefferson Pierce's body, controlling him this whole time, because you can see Dead Man narrating it.
If we're done with this story, we're finally going to get to our Bat Family history, and we're going to do Bat Family history and talk about Martin Pasco.
All right.
A well-known name for people of our sort of generation. Martin Joseph, or Marty Pasco, was born apparently as Jean-Claude Roquefort in Montreal, Canada in 1954. I was not able to find out why he changed his name, and one source even said that he, quote, claimed that this had been his original name. So mystery there. Somebody with better Google foo could maybe figure that out, but I don't know. Nonetheless, as a teenager, he was a regular contributor to comic book letter columns, particularly to comics edited by Julie Schwartz. Beginning in 1968, Pasco was nicknamed Pesky Pasco by Julie in acknowledgement of the fact that his comments were generally pretty critical. His campaign to become a letter call regular as a way of breaking into comics writing was inspired and encouraged by his friend Mike Friedrich, who advised Pasco that a name that was recognizable from the letter columns would have an advantage in terms of selling a story. Marty also had another friend with a recognizable name to those listening to this podcast, Alan Brennert. Marty had gotten Alan's name from a letter column and wrote to him. They started and co-published a fanzine called Fantazine. After attending Northwestern University and New York University, Pasco settled in New York and tried to break into comics. His first published comics writing credit was a short story entitled Package Deal for Warren Publishing's Creepy, number 51 in 1973. But his first published work, however, was a story titled Eye Opener from the year before in Vampirella, which had erroneously been credited to Doug Monk. Bummer, huh? Your first story and you don't even get your name in the credits. So Pasca started working for DC Comics shortly thereafter and began his long association with Superman in 1973 as his letter rating campaign worked on editor Julie Schwartz. Pasco's first Superman-related story was A Private Life of Clark Kent backup feature in Superman number 277 from 1974. Pasco wrote backup stories and other features in Action Comics during this period, such as The Atom. Eventually, Pasco became the featured Superman writer from 77 to 79. In fact, Pasco wrote the first two issues of DC Comics Presents in 1978 with art by network favorite Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
Pasco and Kurt Swan created the Atomic Skull in Superman 323 from 1978 and the Master Jailer in Superman number 331 from 1979. From 79 to 82, Pasco contributed stories to the subject of Sean's next podcast, Superman Family, including runs as the regular writer of the Jimmy Olsen and Supergirl features. In addition, during 78 and 79, Pasco scripted the syndicated newspaper comic strip, The World's Greatest Superheroes, which initially starred most of the Justice League, but gradually changed its focus to primarily feature Superman. If you have been listening to Fire and Water Network for any length of time, then you also know that Marty wrote the solo Dr. Fate story in first issue special number 9 from 1975, which has been covered about a dozen times on the network by Shag. This, of course, was drawn by Walt Simonson. In this story, Marty added the concept that the spirit of Naboo resided in Dr. Fate's helmet and took control of Fate's alter ego Kent Nelson whenever the helmet was donned. In 1981, Roy Thomas incorporated this into his series All-Star Squadron as an explanation for the change in Fate's helmet and powers. Of course he did. In 1982, this led to Kent and his wife Inza having a backup series in The Flash, written by Marty Pasco. These stories are collected in a three-issue limited series titled The Immortal Dr. Fate, 1985. And I wanted to mention those since they're pretty affordable and they're worth getting just to have all those stories put together. It's a nice one of those Baxter thick, like the Dead Man series or the Green Arrow, Green Lantern reprints. It's called The Immortal Dr. Fate. So I just wanted to point that out if somebody's never read those stories. Other titles that Pasco wrote in the 70s included Wonder Woman from 75 to 79, a few issues of Justice League between 1974 and 1977, the Metal Men reboot in 1976 to 77, and all seven published issues of Cobra in 1976 to 77. That is a feature that he redeveloped and recreated and had loosely been based on a very different concept that Jack Kirby came up with. The story intended to be Cobra number 8, appeared in the Batman story in one of my favorite comic books of all time, DC Special Series number 1, the five-star superhero spectacular. And weirdly, Pasco also wrote a Daredevil prose story for Marvel novel series number 9, the Marvel Superheroes, in 1979 under the pseudonym of Kyle Christopher, presumably as to not annoy DC. I can only presume that he got that gig due to knowing Marv Wolfman or maybe more likely Len Wein, who knows? Moving on to the 80s, in his first comics format work for Marvel Comics, Pasco was the regular scripter of Star Trek, the 1980 to 81. I would argue this is not the best Star Trek line of comics, but he did one thing right. He helped his pal Alan Brenner enter the comics industry by having Brenner co-write Star Trek number 12, which was Brenner's first comics work. Back at DC by 82, Pasco and artist Thomas Yates revised Swamp Thing in a new series titled Saga of the Swamp Thing. Pasco left the Swamp Thing with issue 19 and of course was succeeded by Alan Moore. The Swamp Thing stories that Marty Pasco wrote are actually pretty good. They're very overlooked nowadays, obviously, to what followed. 1988 to 89, Pasco again was a regular contributor to Action Comics during his stint as a weekly anthology where he developed a new version of the Secret Six, and he also wrote the Black Hawk feature based on the Howard Chaykin reboot and the subsequent monthly title. But this was not all he was up to. In the 1980s, Pasco lived in Los Angeles. He wrote for or served as a writer story editor on many live-action TV series, including Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, Fantasy Island, The Twilight Zone, the 85 to 89 revival, Max Headroom, which I did not know, Simon and Simon, and Roseanne. Between 1985 and 89, Pasco had a writing and a story editing partner. Her name was Rebecca Parr. However, the partnership was dissolved in 1989, and Pasco's future TV writing credits were exclusively in animation. Parr continued working in sitcoms, notably becoming a writer and executive story consultant on Cheers. Somebody should do a podcast about that show. Anyway, animation was really where he made his mark, though. He had begun a long career in 1980, writing several episodes of Thundar the Barbarian with Steve Gerber. Pasco's many other animated TV writing credits comprise such series as Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Exo Squad, Teen Wolf, Berenstain Bears, G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, and My Little Pony. In the early 1990s, Pasco accepted a job at Disney Consumer Products startup comic book division, Disney Comics, developing a line of superhero titles and writing the Roger Rabbit comic series. The job lasted all of 9 months until, in a corporate reorganization, Disney decided to stop publishing comics altogether. But the day before he was let go by Disney, Pasco had finalized a deal to join Batman the Animated Series as a writer slash story editor. For his work on this series, he, of course, won a 1993 Emmy Award, along with Paul Dini and the rest. And, of course, Pasco is a co-writer of the best Batman movie, The Mask of the Phantasm. In 1994, Pasco returned to New York to serve as DC's group editor for Mass Market. While that was his official title, within the company he was known as the head of the Special Projects Group. In this capacity, he oversaw the production of DC's custom comics, licensed titles such as the Star Trek line, and various special projects such as the writing of stage and stunt shows for the Six Flags Amusement Park chain. I thought you'd like that one, Sean. Yeah. He was also responsible for the writing and production of various webisodes for the newly created Warner Brothers Online. During his decade on staff at DC, Pasco wrote a couple issues of Impulse and the comic book adaptation of the film Superman Returns. Until 2005, he was also DC's liaison to Warner Brothers Studios, vetting scripts for the animated programming, feature film, and animated development of DC brands, and the live-action series Smallville and Birds of Prey, as well as facilitating studio research by supplying comics and consulting on issues related to DC continuity. Whew! In the 2000s, Pasco worked on nonfiction about the various aspects of pop culture history as a writer, researcher, and consultant, as well as writing children's fiction and video game dramatics. These projects include writing The DC Vault, published in 2008. I have this. It's really cool. Yeah. You have that one, Sean? Yeah, it's really cool. You got all these things that come out, and it's really neat. He worked on the dramatics of Freaky Creatures, Abandoned Interactive Entertainment's massively multiplayer online game, co-writing the Essential Superman Encyclopedia with Robert Greenberger, writing the children's book Superman, Prankster of Prime Time, acting as a researcher, consultant, and supplemental copywriter on the 75 Years of DC Comics, The Art of Modern Mythmaking by Paul Levitz. And he was a consultant to numerous independent gaming companies, including Cryptozoic Entertainment, and a freelance comic writer. Unfortunately, Marty Pasco died of natural causes at a very early age of 65 in 2020. Former publisher Paul Levitz, who's a friend of Marty's, had this to say, quote, "The odds are you've read his work, credited or not, or enjoyed a comic or cartoon or TV show or even a theme park event he made better, even as he relentlessly complained about the difficulties of making it as good as it should be," Levitz wrote. Marty didn't have a genius for making anything easy, especially for him, but he had a real genius for making creative magic. Whether commenting on the latest comic he read, the events of the day in politics, creative theory, or just making conversations, Marty had one of the sharpest wits of our generation and opinions. Boy, did he have opinions, Levitz wrote. I learned from him, learned by arguing with him, and took joy in ample helpings with the hamburgers or Chinese food we shared over the decades. Alan Brennert described him as a, quote, kind, generous friend. Quote, "It is difficult to find the words to express my grief," Brennert wrote. "All I can think to say to him is, thank you for writing that first letter to me and becoming part of my life. Thank you for being there when I needed you. I tried to be there when you needed me. Goodbye, Marty. Goodbye, my brother. I will love you and miss you always." According to Mike's Amazing World, Pasco wrote 268 comic stories totaling over 4,000 pages of comic work, the vast majority of which were for DC. His last published story was a Superman tale in Superman Retroactive the 1970s from 2011, which, let's face it, that's super appropriate. He was a mainstay of the Bronze Age of comics for me and probably for everybody listening. No doubt he was even more of an influence on thousands, if not millions of kids and kids at heart for his work on Batman the Animated Series and other animated features. Thanks for letting me talk about him for a while.
That was great. Oh my gosh, so
and isn't it amazing all the stuff?
I know the name, but so many of the things you rattled off on. Oh yeah, I like that. I like that.
Exactly. Great stuff.
Yeah, I remember seeing an episode of Roseanne and seeing written by Martin Pasco, and I was thinking this got to be the same guy because there's no way there's two people with the same name.
Great contributor to all of our growing up and beyond. All right, let's move on to our last story, The Assassination of Batgirl, an 8-pager written by Carrie Burkett, penciled by Rob's favorite teacher from the Kubert School, Jose Delbo, and the inker Joe Giella, and of course, reprinted in Batgirl's Bronze Age Omnibus Volume 2. On our splash page, Batgirl is hanging lifelessly off the roof of a building from a noose. What is going on? We back up a day or two where a crazy-looking crime boss named General Scar is briefing his men. He is mad because Batgirl has moved back to Gotham. I guess he's not afraid of Batman or the Demon or Ragman, but you get the idea. He has hired Cormorant, a hitman with 75 kills who has never failed. So what if he dresses like a Canadian Mountie with a big C on his hat? We cut to Babs on her way to her first day at her new job at the Humanities Research and Development Center. That's a mouthful. We meet some of her new co-workers that I really don't care about, frankly, but we can talk about it in the discussion if you guys want. That night, she gets home and her dad calls and says, Babs, Batgirl might want to come and check something out. So Babs hops on her Batcycle, and when she gets to the location where her dad is, she sees a Batgirl dummy hanging from a noose. Phew, now we know what the splash page meant. So Babs is going to be fine. Commissioner Gordon tells her that GCPD has gotten a note that the dummy would be exploded if anyone went near it except Batgirl. So Babs climbs up her batrope to examine it, but there's no bomb. But of course, it's still a trap, and a gunshot rings out. Batgirl is not hurt, but she loses her grip on the rope. She vaults up onto her assailant's rooftop and gives him the old ballet kick, which knocks Cormorant's stupid hat off. But he recovers quickly and pulls out a little girl hostage? This just got dark real quick. Cormorant threatens to kill the little girl unless Batgirl steps forward. Of course she does and tries to talk him down, but he's having none of it. He just shoots her in the shoulder and she falls off the roof. He looks down and sees Batgirl splayed on the ground. To be continued. What? Guys, what do you think?
Okay, at least unlike the Robin story, the Batgirl feels like it's moving forward. Barbara's got a new job, starting to get some new supporting cast members, even though they've all got the same initials. And we got a new villain who's hiring a low-rent Deathstroke. Interesting story. It's nice that they end the issue on something that's to be continued, so You're going to see the next issue to find out what happens.
I was going to make that comment too, Matthew. I think they switched the order of the Batgirl and the... Because last issue, we ended with the Black Lightning cliffhanger, and this issue, we're ending with the Batgirl cliffhanger. So I do think that was purposeful. So yeah, good catch. How about you, Sean? What are your initial thoughts?
So I like the story. I don't know that I want to say I like it because horrible things happen to Batgirl. But it is, yeah, everything what Matthew was saying, it does feel like it's moving forward. New stuff is happening. I like it. I think, doesn't this story play into that Batgirl solo special?
Yes, because like, she talks about Cormorant, and then Cormorant comes back many years later in a different form, which is kind of neat. Yeah, no, I really like the story. The art is serviceable, but I thought the story was suspenseful. I didn't care much, as you could probably tell from my comments, for the interlude when she goes to her new job, but all the Batgirl sequences I thought were terrific. I think the splash page is striking with the Batgirl dummy in a noose. You can't tell because her hair is in the way of the face. So it's not really her. I think that's a striking splash page. So
I kind of know what you mean about the supporting cast, but that's always a problem when you have a 7 or 8 page story. You don't get to see the supporting cast. But I think it's important to have supporting cast because these people have other people in their lives other than Justice League members.
And right. No, fair point.
And stuff like that.
Fair point.
Again, I don't know that we're going to go beat by beat, but there is absolutely something I have to address in this issue.
Oh, let's hear it.
Page 2, when you're with General Scar.
Whose scar goes right to his part of his hair.
Yeah, it's really creepy. Is that his family name? Is it the Scar? Does he have a little sister Jenny Scar? Yeah, I don't. Anyway, the guy who kind of looks like Lex Luthor in, I guess, panel 4, he whispers, Scar is one of the top crime bosses in Gotham. But does he have to put everything in military terms? Yes, because he's sticking with the theme. Yes, he does.
What was interesting to me is he starts out and these guys look kind of corny, so they don't look like they're much of a threat. But by the end, where he actually just shoots her and she falls off the building, it's like, whoa, they're more of a threat than you think. I kind of like that. Carrie Burkett doesn't get a lot of play in terms of famous writers, but he's written a number of good stories over the years. And I tend to think of him as a journeyman writer from the Bronze Age, but I enjoyed this.
It literally just dawns on me right now. This is a code approved comic from 1980. And there's literally like a gun held to a little girl's head.
I know. That's what I'm saying. It got dark. She's crying. She's got a tape on her mouth. And the guy's holding a gun right in her head.
And he's holding her by her ponytail.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. Ouch.
Well, no, he's holding her off the ground. Is he holding her off the ground?
Off the ground by her ponytail. Ouch.
Although, if you look on the last page panel where he's got stage three and Batgirl walks out, you can see that he's still got the little girl. But look to the next panel over. You see his hand like he's holding the girl, but there's no girl.
Yeah, I think he just pushed her aside then so he could shoot Batgirl. I don't know. I thought page eight was very good. Batgirl's expression at the top of the page. I thought Jose Double did a nice job in the panel that says two.
Yeah.
She's like, I have to step out there. But I've done this before and I'm usually able to talk him down. And that's fully what we expect. She'll be able to talk him down or throw a batarang or something. But no, she gets shot, which is surprising and just a suspenseful story overall. Sean, I caught a typo.
Oh.
Not on page eight. Actually, on page seven.
Page seven. Ooh, what is happening there? Is it sprung? Nah. And everyone knows that when you jump off of a flagpole, it's spring.
It's spring, not sprung. Really? No, it's not really a typo. It's wrong word usage. It's this hostage insures with an I. It should be ensures with an E on the last word bubble of the page.
Oh.
Anyway, so overall, very interested to see what happens next.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Okay, so our last segment, as always, is a trip to Gabriel's Horn. And in this segment, we take a trip to Gabriel's Horn, the hip happening hangout for the Teen Titans in the 1970s. We talk about the most 1980s moment in this issue from any of the stories. Matthew, let's start with you. What do you have?
In the Tales of Gotham City story, Jason Bard's dad found Jason's name in the phone book.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Plus also the reference to serving in Vietnam.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes Jason's dad even more of a bastard because he kicks him in his knee and he calls him weak. Your son's using a cane because he served his country overseas, dude.
No. Yeah, the dad is not a nice guy. As we're recording on Father's Day, everyone.
Yeah.
How about the first story? Do you have anything in that one? Because I have one small one. On page four, Bruce is running out after the guy to jump down the page. He says, I didn't want to blow my double identity by clobbering them in my $300 suit, which would have been a lot back then, and now it's just kind of a regular suit. So I thought that was good. They're smoking, of course, and computers in this story that we've seen before.
Kind of in that same vein. The ski masks, I think they definitely look like, especially for a villain to wear a ski mask like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
In the Jason Bard story, when he does the Christopher Chance undercover and he has that spectacular check suit. Oh my God.
Yeah, that is a spectacular suit. You know, the only thing I thought about in the Jason Bard story is just kind of the inability to find someone. It's much harder today for somebody to get lost.
Yeah, yeah.
Even in movies, there's a whole industry apparently in creating false identity. I don't think it's really that easy to be able to get a job or basically exist without people being able to find you. So that's just kind of a theme. More smoking. The Man in Black is smoking away in the Robin story.
Another phone booth.
Another phone booth, of course.
This is like the phone booth issue.
Yeah. Black Lightning, page six. What is that I have there? Oh, the emergency brake. I had this thing where I was talking last time about the gear shift on the...
Oh, on the dash panel.
Dash panel. But he's pulling the emergency brake on the left, and most of the cars I've seen have it in the middle now.
In the middle now,
so yeah, middle, or a pedal that you step on,
or a pedal you step on. So that looks a little old fashioned. And of course, the workout outfit with the headband—that's pretty 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't really have anything in the back row.
Yeah, I didn't really have anything for that one either.
Not as many as there used to be, as we keep saying.
Yeah.
Well, she was taking a taxi, and nowadays you probably take an Uber.
There you go. That's a good one. All right. I think that's it. That just about wraps it up. Matthew, thank you so much for being on the show and being really one of our most engaged listeners. Do you want to tell people how to get in touch with you and where they can get your song choices or something like that? Do you want to tell us now what your song choices are for the issue, or do you want to put them in the comments?
Well, Sean probably won't know any of them, so...
I'll get to sing it.
You don't want me to sing. No, you don't want me to sing. The dogs will be howling at the very least. So I'll post them in the comments. If you guys like, I can send you a list. I need to finish doing a YouTube playlist.
Videos, a Spotify playlist. Songs. Yeah.
Yeah. I've started it. I need to get it caught up. And
we will promote it if
to
you
this
put
point
it
and then post it. Otherwise, I'm not on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm also on Threads and Instagram, MatthewZD23. I would like to make a plug for my wife. She's an artist. She posts a lot of her work on Instagram under Savage Poodles_Fractals.
Cool.
Yeah, she does some fractal artwork, but she also does a lot of other artwork sketches and stuff. Otherwise, the comment section on Fire and Water Podcast Network.
You're very well known there. Well, thank you again, Matthew. We enjoyed having you on and did great for your first podcast. So we are going to play a podcast promo. And when Sean and I return, we will read and respond to your listener feedback.
I'm scaling this wall just as easily as I can walk. My fingers alone are adhering, supporting me.
The Amazing Spider-Man, created by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, has conquered every medium, from newspaper strips to the silver screen. But he began his life in a pulp periodical destined for cancellation. Let's explore these beginnings together. The Amazing Spider-Man from the very beginning. A brand new podcast on Spotify.
There's some sort of danger here, but what?
Welcome back. Now we will read and respond to your listener feedback for episode 490, Earthquakes, Dance Moves, and Black Lightning, with our special guests Siskoid and Brett Young. Bucky749 kicks us off with his old standby biscuits and gravy, but with a twist. He battered and deep fried them and put them on sticks. Next, Chris Franklin says, I believe in the intro to the Tales of the Demon trade paperback, at least the late 80s, early 90s printing, Denny said he always wanted his last Batman story to have Batman and Talia stroll off together in the sun. Well, Denny was about to jump ship to Marvel as a writer-editor, so this was, at the time, his last Batman story. So, right or wrong, he may have twisted things around just to get to that conclusion. The little ad for the DC TV stars ran last issue, but we forgot to bring it up on air. That Batman is definitely by Dick Giordano, but I'm not sure where it's from. The figures of Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman are from the DC calendar / JLA treasury and could either be Adams Giordano or just Giordano considering the source. Possible nod to Yvonne Craig in the Batgirl story? Craig was trained as a dancer and wore a red wig as Batgirl, whereas Batgirl wears a black wig in disguise as a dancer. Either way, interesting connection.
My pal and past guest Dan Doherty adds his comments. Great show. I agree with Sean. The cover didn't do it for me, and I don't care how much of a Karate Man sensei is, he still looks like a 106-pound old man. Physics would limit his ability to inflict damage on Batman, whose clenched fist could hit him into another time zone. The Batman story's plot motivations were very squishy to me. Batman can beat people like Lurk effortlessly, Gordon's shooting down command, the priest dictating terms, Talia shooting the dart, etc. I agree, Dan. I mean, it's kind of what I was saying, that the whys of the story were not fleshed out enough.
Yeah.
Back to Dan. I like the Batgirl story well enough, and the Black Lightning was very good, but the Robin story? Nursing school college students go after a teacher with guns so they can get a better grade. Wow, that's a tough college. One last thing. Atop the cover, it says 5 all new thrillers, but they basically included a 3-page public service announcement about a police officer pushing a woman's car in those thrillers. Our guest from that very episode, Siskoid, chimed in to disagree on one point with Dan, though, saying that kung fu movies are loaded with the powerful old martial artist, so he didn't see a problem with Sensei. He's of that world. Fair enough, Siskoid.
Past guest and double Paul lunch partner Paul Wildenberger stops by the reunion to say, another great episode, cousins. I have to say, Siskoid had the best response to who his favorite Bat family member is. As always, Paul's creator spotlight was fascinating to hear.
Thank you, Paul.
Something that gave me pause to consider was the mention of Dick's dorm room poster. When I was a kid in the 70s and 80s, my friends and I all had posters in our rooms. Sometimes they were concert posters, some were pullouts from magazines. No, not those magazines.
Sure they weren't, Paul.
Of popular teen stars or musicians. I was the only one I know of that had actual comic book posters. What I was wondering about Dick's poster was whether it was drawn pictures or a photo poster a la Farrah Fawcett. If the latter, I can't imagine Bruce posing for something like that. Maybe a lucky newspaper photographer got a good shot while Batman was taking down a major opponent, Signal Man. More likely, some enterprising promoter hired a square-jawed model and dressed him up in a knockoff bat suit. I think Dick would have gotten a good laugh when he found that poster in the school bookstore. I look forward to listening to my fellow Bat cousins in the next episode.
I like that.
Well, I actually think I kind of have a no prize for this, maybe.
Okay.
I'm imagining if all the donations went for the Wayne Charity Foundation. Sure. So maybe they could work around it that way to get the actual Batman reel to pose for that.
Next up, we have future guest and Patreon supporter Brian Schufo drops by the reunion to add his 2 cents. Hello, Bat Cousins. I brought Italian ice made from the scrapings of sleet and snow from the car of the woman stranded on the streets of Gotham City in the storm. I like the idea of the Tales of Gotham City story in this issue, but it needed a better twist ending. Imagine a similar storyline, but instead of a random unnamed police officer giving a car a push, it was one of the members of the Batman family. Alfred, Francine Langstrom, Talia al Ghul, Dula Dent, even Dick's old girlfriend, Lori. The more unexpected, the better. Unless the Tales of Gotham City stories are required to feature a cop from the GCPD. If that's the case, then in his best Gilda Radner voice, never mind. I kind of like your idea, Brian.
I like that too. I think that's a good twist.
Yeah.
Our Bat fashionista, Liz Ann Oswald, says, impressive podcast, most impressive. Thanks as always, Liz Ann. Liz Ann starts off her comments with an interesting story. She actually had a situation where she helped someone push her car out of the snow. So the Tales of Gotham City story really spoke to her. Check out the website to read the whole story. And thanks for sharing, Liz Ann. Other comments from Liz Ann. The cover. Now we see how Batman would look in the movie Dirty Dancing. Wait, they put Talia in a corner? No one puts Talia in a corner. Then you have Sensei doing a 70s kung fu kick. No one in real life would ever use this. Finally, Raish is angry he didn't get a close-up.
That's a good reason.
Next story. Was it the Dancing with the Stars issue? Batgirl doing the reverse bit with the wig is fun. Ooh, Robin in just his green Speedos. Sexy mess. I may need a moment. Okay, next. Black Lightning. I always think of the Sinbad bit on Saturday Night Live when I see him. That is funny. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, me too.
Liz Ann, I love Saturday Night Live, yeah.
Next up, our Bat Cousin and guest of this very episode, the Bat DJ himself, Matthew Davis, had this to say. Tasty cakes. Batman, the final countdown by Europe, and I swear, if Sean says he hasn't heard this song.
As featured on Arrested Development.
There you go. What church does Reverend Rini belong to? I can't believe he's so anti-weapon that he doesn't even want a security detail. Nice to see his convictions are strong enough to put his fellow clergy at risk. The whole religious leader conference could have been interesting if there had been some build-up to it. I agree with that. Batman told McManus to wait for him in the Batcave. How long was he waiting there while Batman recovered with Talia? Did Alfred at least put on a ski mask and bring him a sandwich? Batgirl, Tiny Dancer by Elton John.
I will say right now, I'm sick of the Tony Danza joke about that.
The father is 45 and his son thinks he's ready to be put out to pasture. Man, I've never wanted to punch a comic book character so much. I was 13 when this came out. Maybe then 45 seemed old. Tales of Gotham City, the theme music from NBC's The More You Know segment.
Dun, 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 dun.
This seemed like one part filler, one part PSA. Decent and charming throwback to a time when Jim Gordon wasn't the only altruistic member of the GCPD. Robin, Teacher, Teacher by 38 Special.
I have no idea.
Has anyone asked Bob Rozakis, the real answer man, if this answer man was an inside nod to him? Yeah, we should have, but don't know the answer to that. No one stands out on a 1970s college campus more than a middle-aged guy in a black suit and fedora. Not even a superhero with a yellow cape. Black Lightning, theme from Welcome Back, Cotter.
Welcome back.
I like Black Lightning, and this was a good reintroduction to the character. Thanks to my wife, who will have channels like Rewind TV running in the background, yeah. I read Link's line in Boom Boom's voice. It's a decent story, despite the 70s slang and the Haitian voodoo stereotype. I do like Pat Broderick's artwork. His run on Firestorm a few years after this was one of my favorites. Absolutely. Another fun episode. Can't wait for the next one. Thanks, Matthew. And once again, you did a great job in your first podcast for sure. Thanks for coming to the reunion today.
Next up, our bat cousin from across the ocean, Martin Gray, says, hello there. I've just made a vegetarian Moroccan spiced aubergine and lentil stew, and it is stupendous. So I'm bringing the extra to the barbecue. I think that sounds fantastic. I agree the cover is not good this time. The way Batman and the Sensei are crossing looks really, really weird. Talia is the best thing on that cover, and I hate Talia. She's DC other answer to Mantis. I didn't read the Batman story again this month because it's Denny O'Neil and his boring League of Assassins guff yet again. There should have at least been a big surprinted Kathy Kane in the final panel, which would have been a splash page. I agree with that, Martin. That is a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
Actually, Sean, there is an excellent collection of Legends of the Batman in the UK. part of the DC Heroes and Villains collection from Hatchet, issue 32. And it does indeed include some other great tales, and one from 2014, namely The Untold Legend of the Batman, all three issues. There Is No Hope in Crime Alley from Detective Comics 457, March of 76. To Kill a Legend from Detective Comics number 500, March 81. The Man Who Falls from Secret Origins of the World's Greatest Superheroes, March 1990. The Case of the Chemical Syndicate from Detective Comics number 27, March 2014. You also get an intro, an outro, and other feature material, all in glorious hardback for £9.99. There are a few copies going cheap on eBay. I quite like the Tales of Gotham City story. It reminded me of those Justice Story shorts we'd get in Justice League Super Spectaculars. The message was just that things aren't always as bad as they could be. I love the Bob Smith info. These features are one of the best parts of the show. I agree with that, Martin. Absolutely.
Thank you, Martin.
I want to be a 3-time guest too, but you're probably all booked up. Just pencil me in for Superman Family Feud. That is not, I'm not saying it's not happening. I'm just not going to be part of it. I will listen to every episode. I will participate as much as they want me to or let me, but it's not up to me.
Unfortunately, we are finally booked up, Martin. So we'll have to wait for the next podcast, which we're keeping under wraps right now. Next up, one of the guests from that very episode, Brett Young, says, great show, Bat Cousins and Siskoid and other brilliant guests. Riveting shovel talk, and I learned some French, but I have since forgotten it. As always, it was great being part of the show. It's hard to make a 4-man booth in sports, but it was brilliant when discussing bat things. Thanks, Brett. And then we go on to our favorite bat nephew, Isamu, who was a man of few words this month, but big action. He says, looking for DC Comics subscription house ads? Here you go. And he created a webpage on the Batman Family Reunion feed that has over 20 subscription ads. It is fantastic. Once again, Isamu, you have gone above and beyond and exceeded all expectations. Thanks so much. I recommend everybody who listens, check it out. If you go onto our network's website, you can see it under our show. But Isamu also posted a link in his comments.
Yes, Isamu, you were fantastic. You did a great job. Don't do any other research homework on this episode. That's an order. And network co-founder, feature guest, and noted Floridian, Rob Kelly, finishes us off with, thanks for all those subscription ads, Isamu. Some of them I have never seen before. How is that possible? It always seemed odd to me that Batman Family was used for characters who were most definitely not part of the family. Black Lightning, Odd Man, and soon Red Tornado, when the more all-purpose World's Finest was right there. On the flip side, you've got a Green Arrow hostess ad, and I could picture his solo strip fitting in a lot more in Family. So this is Sean. I kind of agree with Rob, although to take Odd Man out of Batman Family would be like cutting a piece of my heart out. Finally, I love the chaotic nature of this issue's cover. Usually, Giordano was spot on with this stuff, but this has a slightly Mad Magazine feel to it. People just coming in from all directions, seemingly disconnected from any sense of gravity. I love it. Brett Young is quickly becoming the Regis Philbin of Batman Family Reunion. You can decide for yourself what I mean by that. On that note, let's move on to social media. So we have lots of likes and favorites and forwards and replies and rehashtags and all of those. And I'm just going to read them off now willy-nilly. I'm not going to say whether it's Facebook or X or Twitter or LinkedIn or JDate or Grindr or whatever. It's a free-for-all. Codex Omniversa, Matthew Davis, Nikimo Hideki Yukinori, Paul Wildenberger, Tom Pincinault, Max Romero, Tim Price, Carol Teague, Chris Franklin, Derek Burke, Alan E. Boyce Jr., Jim Weasley, Brett Young, Mike Thomas, Brian Schufo, Ange, Steve Whitbread, Martin Gray, Bill, also known as the Batpod, Isamu, Harold Wallen, Martin Menza, Jim Ball, Chris, Rodney Trainum, Dr. Pop Culture, Just Trying to Browse. And if I missed anyone, it's completely my fault. I'm doing this away from my home. I'm at a work conference, so I had to willy-nilly grab what I could. So if I forgot your name, please forgive me. Next month, I'll probably get it right. Before we sign off, as most of our listeners know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network has gotten more costly over the years as more and more shows were added. So if you are enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the other shows, please consider becoming a patron. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice. And our special thanks go to our Bat cousin and future guest, Brian Schufo, who has asked to be named on Batman Family Reunion. Thanks, Brian. Remember, we are not all Bruce Wayne, but any small amount you can give helps defray the cost, and we promise that none of the donated money will be used for plastic surgery to make me look more like Hephaestus. To find out how, go to patreon.com/FWpodcasts. Thanks.
That'll do it for the feedback section and for episode 491. Once again, we want to thank our special guest and first-timer, Bat DJ Matthew Davis, for appearing on this episode. He did great for his first podcast. Thank you all for listening. And we hope you will join us next month as we welcome another international podcaster to the reunion as we cover the return of Man-Bat and the big Batman-Batgirl team-up. Yay, Batman!